Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt, and I'm back in the studio with the one, the only, Mr. Jack Piatelli. Jack, how are we doing?
Doing really well. Yep, doing really well. A little tired today. A long drive back from Ithaca, but it was well worth it. Great weekend for the Big Red, so we're going ahead. And
I'm still upset John didn't get drafted, but, you know, not everyone listens to me, right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. But fortunately for you listening, we have an excellent guest today. Joining us via Zoom is Westwood High head coach Todd Zahurek. Coach, how we doing?
Doing fantastic, guys. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
So, you know, again, I'm kind of a newbie when it comes to covering MIAA, but I took a little look at your schedule. You play a kind of a murderer's row teams here, man. You're still in Division II after the shuffle. How has that affected you? Because now Medfield's in Division III, and that was kind of the boogeyman of your conference over there.
Yeah, you know, it really was. The realignment really didn't do a whole lot for our regular season schedule. You know, our league stuff stayed the same. But it certainly changes the rules when it comes to the state tournament here. And we're looking forward to it.
Todd, what do you think of the new alignment? Again, you said it hasn't really changed in terms of your league play, but how will it affect the state tournament? You like what they've done with the alignment? My experience over the years being in Massachusetts my entire life, it seems like they're always changing something every couple of years.
Yeah, Jack, you know, I'm glad that they change it. We've been using the old format for a little while here. And there's positives and negatives to no matter how you do it. So I'm excited for a chance to kind of have a statewide bracket, get out and see some other teams from other regions and see how we stack up with, you know, similar sized schools across the state, as opposed to just the guys that we see year in and year out in our region.
Can you explain to our listeners the difference from the format that was present 2 years ago, because we didn't have a season last year?
Yeah, the most recent format that we've used was a regional format. So it was a north, central, south, and west brackets. And, you know, you played everybody within there, and then each region would send a team to the Final Four for the state tournament. And now they've changed it, and it's just a statewide bracket right now. So they'll rank everybody with their power formula and play it out from there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're going to have the top seed playing the bottom seed, and everybody just plays the next seed based on whoever wins, like the NCAA does it. And most playoffs formats play it out every year.
Yep, exactly.
Coach, I'm just looking at your staff here, and, you know, I'm a JV coach, and I'm also a varsity assistant. I notice you guys have JV. How different do you separate your JV and your varsity when you practice, or do you all play together? Do you have separate kind of goals for those teams, or are you all really like one big team? Because I think there's a couple ways to do that.
Yeah, you know, we share a field and we do a lot of stuff together. But when it comes time for 6-on-6 or working on specific plays or specific roles within the teams, we do separate out. So probably. If you force me to put a number on it, we probably spend about half the time together and then half the time separated.
Todd, you're from upstate New York. You went to Oswego State. You played for a great man, and I've gotten to know over the years, and a legend in the coaching in upstate New York, Dan Whitner. After your playing career, what actually got you into coaching and why?
Well, you know, I'm a high school guidance counselor, so I've always kind of known that I wanted to be in schools, and coaching was just seemed to be a natural extension of staying in the game. So I coached with Coach Whitmer for a year. I did started my graduate work up there, and then moved out to Boston and started coaching full time from there. You know, I've been on a sideline for close to 30 years now, and love doing it. Love being around the kids and the opportunities that it presents. So really been a rewarding career path for me.
I'm actually really familiar with Dan. His son, Brian and I are friends. Yep. And we go way back. I didn't realize that was a connection there. Just another more proof that lacrosse world is shockingly small.
Everybody knows somebody.
Right. So Brian is actually the head coach of the Czech national team.
Yep, I'm aware of that.
Yeah. What is your involvement with that been? Like, I know you're a coach as well. Have you talked to him and his dad about any of that kind of process with the international game?
Not really with the international game at all. Coach Whitmer and I talk regularly about high school lacrosse. He's picked up a team out there. Quite honestly, he's forgotten more lacrosse than I'll ever know. So anytime I bump into a question or a problem that I'm having with my team, he's definitely one of the first guys I reach out to for some help. And, whether that's a personnel issue or a more team oriented conundrum that I'm trying to deal with, he's definitely a first call for me.
Coach, I watched a video interview that was done with a student athlete during the pandemic. And yep. You were quoted as saying that from year to year, you may lose half of your roster.
Yeah. As a varsity program, you carry 25 ish guys and, half of them are juniors, half of them are seniors. So you're looking at roughly half of the guys that we're trying to replace every year. 50% might be a little bit high, but it's not unusual to lose. We have 11 seniors this year and we're carrying 23 guys. So, it's part of the deal.
How is that dynamic with a senior heavy team? I actually have that this year with the varsity. And I don't know if Massachusetts has the same rule in New Hampshire. Seniors can't play JV.
Is
that true with you guys? Yep. So I find that actually creates, some playing time issues for those seniors. Have you encountered anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that no matter what you – no matter where you are, you're going to bump into those kinds of issues. And I think it's really important to be very upfront and very clear with the guys coming into the season about what your expectations are for them. As far as playing time and participation in practice. And as long as you kind of keep those lines of communication open, I really haven't had a lot of issues about them. But I certainly have had difficult discussions with guys about where they fit in with the team. And how their role is going to play out through the season.
Coach, I know you like to play fast. Explain exactly how you work with your team and get them prepared to play fast.
Sure. We first of all, we do a lot of conditioning. I think that's something that we work on all year, not just in season. But if you're going to play at speed, you have to be able to operate there without really getting too much of a drop off in your skill level as the game goes on. But then we also do a lot of uneven situation stuff in practice, just trying to take advantage of the uneven situations as they occur. And whether that's out of a rider or clear or simply out of the game itself, just trying to take advantage of as much of it as we can.
Can you give me an example of a drill that you use to teach how to play fast? That isn't a full field drill, like something that you can apply or that coaches listening can apply to kind of get their kids to think about moving the game a little faster.
Yeah. I two for you. We actually used these in practice yesterday. The first one is simply a 5-on-4 from midfield where we have the offensive middies come in from the wings and the defensive middie come in from the faceoff dot. And it forces the offense to create, an uneven, a 2-on-1 somewhere on the field. And whether that's right away with the midi that bringing the ball down or swinging the ball through X and hitting the backside cutter, trying to make sure that everybody's on the same page, that our cutters are working the right way and creating those opportunities for goal scoring. And the other one I just picked up this offseason, I'll try to explain it to you the best I can. You start with you have six lines. You have three lines, and you're all around the box. You have three lines of defense at the top of the box, and you have an offensive line on each wing, and then one offensive line also at the top of the box. the ball starts at X. So you have a coach roll the ball in from there. And the offense has to go get the ball. The defense has to set up and defend it. You have to find your guys, make sure the communication is there. And then the wrinkle that we add is after two completed passes, we add a fourth offensive player. So we really like that. It forces communication on the defense. It forces the ball movement on offense to try to find those easy shots. So those are two drills that we like, and we've had some success using.
It sounds like a modified 4-on-3.
Yeah. Yep. That's exactly what it is.
That's awesome. Yeah. I'm going to steal that, just so you know. I'm going to use it probably today.
Yeah. Okay. As an offensive guy, I think the key to being a good offensive player, obviously, is the understanding of what's actually happening in front of you, and to recognize when you're 3-on-3 and then all of a sudden you're at an advantage. You have the extra player. A lot of players don't see that extra play coming into the offense, and obviously that's crucial in a game situation. So I like the drill very much. Again, I think it's gives the players an opportunity to recognize when they have the advantage and push the ball.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
So, Coach, another question for you in regards to the way you play. You also quoted as, you coach during practice a lot of X's and O's and drills, and you were quoted as saying that it's the responsibility of the players for them to develop their own skills and play wall ball. And I know a lot of coaches talk about wall ball, but can you specifically tell us a little bit about what your expectations are in terms of wall ball and how it applies to your players?
Well, you know, Jack, as you guys know, being able to pass and catch is really the essence of what we're doing here. So, getting the ball in and out of your stick in a timely manner is really what we have to have. So I don't really have a specific drill or goal for the guys, but I do expect them to be able to, get out to a wall and really hone your skills. My brother is a musician, and I think that the way that he talks about practice is kind of the way that I would like to look at it. He says that practice is for the individual to get better, and rehearsal is for the team to get better, for his band to get better. So, if we're looking at that, I like how he talks about, practice should be on your own. You should be working on your individual skills, your stick skills, your dodging, your fitness, all of those kinds of things. And then when you get together with your team, that's really when the focus should be on the collective, not the individual.
Coach, you mentioned you do a fair amount of conditioning. Do you maintain that throughout the year? And what's kind of, I keep asking you for drills just because I want them. So can you give me a good conditioning drill? And like, what's your philosophy on that? Because I know that a lot of coaches either don't use conditioning or use it in the beginning and then kind of taper it off. And then there's some guys that do it all year.
Yeah, we do it all year. I'm a firm believer that you do need to stay on top of that. With an eye on who's playing and what our week looks like and all of those kinds of things. Probably our most famous drill is we call them 20-40s, where you have 20 seconds to go end line to end line, and you have 40 seconds to get back. And then you start the next one on the minute, every minute. And we say that we do them every week until everyone on the team can do 12 consecutive. So that's, a quarter's worth of sprinting. So those are pretty vicious to do.
It sounds almost as bad as the beep test. Have you done a beep test?
I have. It's a similar, it's a little bit longer. It's similar.
Yeah.
Now, in the conditioning drills that you work with your players, do you have them carry a ball in their stick to develop their skills, or is it strictly running conditioning drills?
For the conditioning stuff, I want them to focus on the conditioning. So I don't have them carrying a ball or executing another skill. But what we will do is, as soon as the fitness period is over, we immediately jump into a basic stick skill drill, so that you're practicing those skills while you're tired. I think that's really important as well.
And what are some of the drills you like to use to develop the player's skills?
You know, honestly, Jack, basic line drills. You know, that's something that, you know, it's easy. You don't have to think about it. Everybody knows how to do them. You just jump right into them when you're tired. And, you know, you get used to executing those skills while you're tired. And then, you know, we have variations on line drills. But that's really what we rely, fall back on and use a lot.
Do you focus on the number of touches the players get during, you know, those line drills? Do you have more lines so they get more touches in a situation like a lot of coaches have gone away with the basic line drills.
Yeah. They're not my favorite to do, but in this situation, I do like them. When we do our line drills, we try to keep the lines under five. And then we stole a drill from our girls team, where it's a three-man line drill. And I think that those are fantastic. So, you know, it depends. We try to vary it within reason, but still keeping it pretty basic.
It's funny you mentioned that, Jack. I actually am one of those coaches that doesn't do line drills anymore. We do a box drill, which is four corners that we just make pre-game. We do it before every practice as well, after our stretching. What's your pre-game warm-up look like for you guys?
Yeah, we actually just changed it. We were earlier in the season. We found that we weren't playing well in the first quarters of games. So we really changed it and went a little more intense, but less contact. So we had been doing a lot of 4v3s, 5v4s, uneven stuff like that. And we just found that guys got into patterns and we didn't like it. So we changed it up. We're doing a lot more individual things right now. So guys come out and we get, we do triangles, not boxes. That's our typical. Then we stretch. We do some stick work. We do some shooting. We do a clearing drill. And then we do a sliding drill to get our defense moving. And then we do a quick 6-on-6 and call it a day. So our pregame warm-up is about 25 minutes end to end.
Coach, you mentioned that you play fast. Teams that play fast have to have a way to get the ball back as well. What's your plan for that? Are you ride based? Are you trap defense based? Do you play a zone? How do you kind of manipulate the tempo of the game on the defensive side of the ball?
Kyle, that Z word is a dirty word to me. So let's not do that.
Oh, you're anti zone. I love it. No. Now I have zone follow ups. Go ahead.
I will throw it in there once in a while, but we typically don't like it. We like to press out on defense. I have one of my defenders is very good. He's committed to Western New England, Thomas DeMeo. So we like to get him in some space and let him do his thing. And then our long stick midi is extraordinary. So we kind of rely on those guys to put the ball on the floor and get it up for us.
Why do you hate zone?
I think it takes the air out of the game. I think it's boring to play. I think it's boring to play against. It can be very effective. I will give it that. So when you're overmatched, it's a great way to shorten the game. But I just, it's boring and not fun.
I feel like it's one of those things where I love the concept of it, right? Like I love like, oh yeah, well we can throw this at another team and it'll mess them up. And then like when I'm coaching against it and I'm coaching on it, I'm like, I hate this. I hate it so much because you really need a lot of offenses are picks or cuts and you can't really run picks against the zone, right?
Right.
You can, it's just not going to work and you can only use them off ball. Right. And I hate that because I'm very much a pick person. I used to be a cut person. I feel like that's now the divide in higher levels of lacrosse is pickers versus cutters. And I think there are coaches that you already mentioned that you run cutters. So I feel like you're a cutter guy, especially if you play fast. But where do you land on that side of the wall?
I'm sorry. As far as like picks and
for
cuts?
For picks and cuts, yeah.
Yeah, I'm more of a cut guy. I have a pretty good box background, so I do like on-ball picks. But I find that most kids can't execute them well. So it's the amount of time that you have to spend to teach them and learn them and get used to doing them it's not a great way to get high school guys to run them. So we do a lot more motion offense. And I think it's a little bit easier for kids to grasp and it works out well for us.
you're talking about kind of skill development. What's the relationship like with the high school and the like the town program in Westwood?
I talk fairly regularly to the town program and to try to get them. I think it's really hard because it's tremendously important to give as many kids the opportunity to play, which means that you get a lot of, hopefully you're getting a lot of newer kids playing at all levels of youth. So it is difficult to kind of, give them an offense and say, hey, we're going to run this in varsity, which is 5 years away, and I need you guys to start teaching it. But I do try to give them some concepts to run both offensively and defensively and you know, try to help everybody out. Sometimes I'm better at that than others.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the zone, and you see it more and more in the college game. But at the youth level, I've actually coached against teams that in the fifth grade, sixth grade, coaches have a zone defense, and I believe it's the lazy coach and the lazy player's way out. You're not teaching any, you know, defensive man-to-man, sliding, and really the basic concepts of playing defense. Your thoughts on what you see in the college game today in terms of zone defense and the way the game is being played?
Yeah, you know, in the college level, I think it's great. It is a way, guys are so skilled coming out of high school now and playing in college that defenses have to react to it. And if you're playing one defense the whole game in college, it's going to be ineffective. So you do have to have multiple defenses. So in that aspect, it's effective and it works. And I think you have to have it, but below that, or, especially at a youth level, you're not teaching the guys how to play. You're just putting them out there and saying, just stand here and you're not doing anything.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message.
This fall, Quincy College in Quincy, Massachusetts drops the puck on its first ever hockey season in the City of Presidents, just 10 minutes from Boston. The Granite, as they're known, will play in the CHF Collegiate Hockey Federation against Babson, Mass Maritime, Nichols, Sacred Heart, and D3 programs at UNH and Farmingdale State in New York. The Quincy College Granite will be well coached. Kyle Robertson has been coaching regional junior teams for 20 years, and over 100 of his players have gone on to NCAA programs. Kyle's assistant is Matt Gibbons, who's been coaching at North Quincy High for 12 years and won 3 titles there. 3 years ago, he was the MIAA Coach of the Year. And as far as the educational part, Quincy College has a lot to offer. 37 different 2-year degrees, and it's super affordable. There's even a new 4-year business management degree that costs much less than other 4-year schools. Want to make some history in a first-year hockey program? Now's your chance. Get more info at quincycollege.edu/hockey. Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media. Inspiring. Informative. Insightful.
This year has been fun to coach my JVs, but there was one game where we matched up against a team that was a division higher than us in their JV team. And I expected them to be skilled and ready and stuff, but all they were doing was junking the ball on Gilman's on clears and playing zone. And I get upset sometimes on the sideline, but I've never been so upset as when they kept Gilmaning the ball. And I looked, I don't talk to coaches during games. I just looked over through the box and I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Cause we're here. I feel like JV is a place to teach, like, you know, and I think, you know, it's not, if you're an experienced coach, you can have a really big impact on a JV player more so, I think, than a varsity player. Have you kind of found that in your development of players on your team?
You know, I tell my JV guy, who's fantastic, by the way, he's a young man named Kevin Sennett. He's tremendous with my players. And I tell him that his biggest job is to make sure that everybody comes back the next year, that you know, they have fun, that they learn something about the game, and that they want to come back the next year. And I think that if you're playing things like zone, that you're not, because you're not able to test yourself athletically, and you're just kind of standing around. So I agree with you. You know, JV is a tremendously impactful time.
How often do guys go from JV as freshmen to, you know, playing or starting for you as sophomores or juniors?
Pretty regularly. You know, when we go back and look at our JV guys, you can see the athleticism in them, and then they're on the JV team to pick up the stick skills, to pick up the team concepts that translate into what we're trying to do on varsity. So, you know, earlier I mentioned that we practice together quite a bit, and that is to kind of get those guys ready for the varsity level.
You're located kind of in a, I would say, a hotbed for club teams, right? There's a lot of teams in your area where kids could play for multiple different club teams in the summer. What's your view on that, and how do you navigate that as a high school coach?
You know, I'm mixed, because I think that there is a pretty good divide between the haves and the haves not as far as who can afford to play club. Mm-hmm. But I also fully recognize that anybody that has aspirations to play beyond high school has to. You know, those guys have to get out and be seen on the summer circuit, because, you know, as we all know, recruiting doesn't take place in high school anymore. It's all almost exclusively done through the club programs. So there is a place for it. I think it's a little too much right now, but that's not for me to decide.
How involved are you in helping your players make the decision of where they go and kind of what level you think they can play in college?
As much as they want me to be. I certainly make the offer to any and all of my players that I'll help them in any way that I can, call coaches, help them try to figure out where to go as far to pursue their academics. Because, I mean, you know, college lacrosse is great, but it's 4 years of your life and that's it. You have to go be a man the rest of your life. So it's much more important to have the right fit at school and making sure that your academics and your social stuff lines up well, as well as the lacrosse stuff does. You know, what happens if, you know, you go to college, you get hurt, the coach leaves, you just decide you don't want to play anymore, you get burned out. There's all kinds of reasons why you may not make it as a lacrosse player. So it's tremendously important to have all of those other factors kind of ready to go and lined up for the kids.
Can you give a specific example? You don't have to use a name, but can you give a specific example of where that has worked out for one of your players?
You mean somebody that went to college and
yes.
It didn't?
Or worked
sure.
out.
You know, I had a young, I'm sorry?
Or worked out, either way.
Yeah, I had a young man who was a very good midfielder. He graduated about 6 years ago. He was being looked at by some lower end Division I, high end Division III schools, and he made a decision to go to school just north of New York City for their business program, and that in turn has, you know, worked out great for him. It wasn't a particularly good lacrosse school, but it's worked out for him professionally, where he's now in getting an MBA and has a job lined up with one of the big five financial firms coming up here this summer. So it is, you know, it's important to make sure that you have your ducks in a row when it comes to, you know, where lacrosse should fall in the priority of your life.
Coach, I'm going to change gears. I think the college game has terms of the pace because of the shot clock. It's become very exciting to watch, and I know you like to play fast. And in Massachusetts and in Connecticut and a lot of New England states, the private schools have picked up the shot clock. Your thoughts on the shot clock, and do you ever see it becoming available in the MIAA anytime soon?
So I love the shot clock. Love it. I love that it forces offense. It forces guys to play. It forces you to go to the goal. All of those kinds of things. I would be very hesitant to put it in high school in the MIAA right now. Just I think it would have a disproportionate effect on the lower level teams. So teams that are struggling a little bit are going to have a hard time meeting a shot clock timeline. So I think that it would be, I think it disproportionately benefits good teams and punishes poor teams. You could argue that, if you get better, but if you have a developing program, it could be really hard to deal with. I have not heard a lot of people talking about putting it into the MIAA, so I don't really see that happening anytime soon. I wouldn't be opposed to it just because I like that style of lacrosse. I like that brand of lacrosse. I think it's much more exciting, but I also don't think that it's really been a big problem in high school where teams. I don't see a lot of teams stalling. You see it at the end of a game, but I really don't see it much more than that.
Yeah, because if you're a team, you're up by 10 goals. After the first half, the shot clock in college is 80 seconds, so yeah. You're forced to take another shot, and normally you could hold on to the ball, so. What are you're really telling your players not to take a shot, but you got to take a shot because you have the shot clock. So yeah. Your point is very well taken. In terms of the college shot clock, what stands out to you in terms of what you like most about it?
I think that they got the timing of it right. I like the 80 second on the initial one. So you have your time to clear and then set up your offense. And then on the 60 second restart, I think that's a good balance between, forcing a shot. I find like the PLL shot clock, I find it to be a little too fast. You're not really seeing a whole lot of good team offense. And granted you're also dealing with guys that are the best in the world and just tremendous players. But I do like how the 60 seconds does allow you some time to set up an offense and work the ball a little bit before you have to, get a shot off.
Yeah. I like the adjustment they made this year on the reset. So the reset now is 60 seconds on the offensive end. If you get a push or, a turnover situation, instead of 80 seconds. But what I really like about the shot clock is teams are riding and you're seeing a lot of turnovers, and actually teams are putting in 10 man rides. You didn't see 10 man rides before the shot clock. So it's become such an important part of the game, an exciting part of the game, which is great to watch.
Absolutely. Anything that puts the ball on the floor and gets guys running around chasing it is going to be a win in my book. Love watching that style. Love seeing those guys get up and down the field. Love seeing the play of the long sticks. The long stick middies have been tremendous this year. So that's really been a lot of fun to watch.
Coach, looking at your results this year, you've actually gone up quite a bit on a few teams. What's your philosophy on what happens when you're up by 10? What, you briefly touched on it, but what is your personal thought on that? Because I think I'm of a different opinion than most people. I think you just play your freshmen and your sophomores. I feel like if they score, they score. I feel like that's a way for them to learn. And some people are just like, no, we dump the ball. I feel like that's a waste.
Yeah, I agree with you. I try to play my second and third string guys, and give them opportunities to score. I have no problem telling my top guys that they can't shoot. I have a hard time telling my sixth attackman that he can't shoot, because not for nothing, but this may be the only time that he gets the opportunity to score this year. And I just have a hard time saying to that kid, sorry, man, you can't do it. I'll play my lesser players, and certainly give them opportunities to do well. And then after that, it's on you to not get scored on.
I think the opposing coaches should understand that, and they know that you've got your second and third string in there, and if they score, they score. I mean, that, yeah. They don't allow them to score if you have your second and third string in there.
Right, right. And you know, Kyle, I've certainly been on my share of the other end of that as well, and I would never ask another coach to not shoot at us, especially if you have your other players in there.
Yeah, I think I'm lucky this year to coach on a team where we're on the good end of that. But I know when I coached in college, it was very different, very young, new program. And I remember we played – I'm actually going to say the school so everyone can look it up and make fun of me. We played Emmanuel, and Emmanuel was up 5-0 on us at the half. And I remember pulling everyone in for the huddle, and everyone's dead. And I'm like, guys, this team's better than us. 5 goals is fine. We're actually doing a great job. We haven't even had the ball in offense, right? And the rest of the game, we played hard, and we got beat 15-0. It's the only time in my college career, coaching career ever in my life, I've been shut out. And after the game, I went up to the coach, and I said, thank you.
Yep.
And he just looked at me like, what? And I was like, it could have been 30, man. You know, like, right. I know you put your subs in, and you still pounded us. But that's, like, I feel like that part of lacrosse is lost on a lot of parents specifically. Mm-hmm. When they see a team not play well against a team that is, you know, technically better. How do you navigate that as a head coach of a program? I mean, I'm sure it's happened at least once or twice to you. What's your way of dealing with that for parents and the players?
You know, the players, you just, when you're on the field, you're playing. It's your best effort no matter what. And when whatever your best effort is what I expect. It's up to me as the coach to make sure that I'm not running things up unnecessarily. I don't have my kid that scored 9 goals shooting for his 10th. So that's on me to make sure I'm putting kids in positions to be successful, but not embarrassing the other team. And then as far as parents go, I really don't have a lot of control over that. It's, you know, if you're not on my sideline, you're not in my huddle, then hey, that's on you. You figure yourself out.
Coach, here's a question for you. So you've got an attackman, starting attackman. It's 3 minutes left in the game. You're up 15-4. He's got one more goal to get to 100. What do you do? Do you keep him in, or you sit him on the bench?
You know, Jack, that's a brutal question. what's the situation? Are there more games left in the season?
No, last game of the season.
Leave him in.
Yeah.
Get him his 100, and you know that's a marker that he'll remember, that people will remember. So if it's a situation like that, leave him in, get him the goal.
Yeah, absolutely. If I was that player, I'd be very upset with you, coach, if you didn't leave me in. But
yep.
I've seen a number of coaches over the years at the high school level, you know, they'll leave their starters in the attackmen and, you know, way beyond where they should be in terms of playing time, and just to keep them in there to get their points. And it's just so aggravating. And you look at, you know, the top scorers in Massachusetts sometimes, and you actually take a look at where they scored their most goals in the second half against, you know, not a very strong team or
bad team high school.
And yeah. It just doesn't do anything for the game. It doesn't do anything for the player. And what are you trying to prove? That he's right. Really good against weak competition? Let's see what he does against very strong competition instead right. of, you know, and you see it and I've seen it. Yep. And then
Jack, I had a kid a couple of years ago that was an absolutely tremendous player, probably the best player that ever came through my program. And we used to joke that the only person in the state who could hold him to 3 goals was me. And, you know, that was it. You know, we when we played Dover and Medfield, Hopkinton and the top teams on our schedule, I let him in, you know, and said, hey, you can get as many as you want today. But when we're playing some of the lesser teams, you're going to get a couple of minutes and then you're going to come stand by me and get everybody else better. So, you know, I completely agree with you guys on that.
Yeah. And unfortunately the players who score the most goals and get the most points, I'm not talking obviously the defensive players, that's a whole different animal, end up getting a lot of the accolades and they base it on points instead of actually you know, your competition and what you did against the better teams.
Yeah.
Yep. I may be generalizing, but it's unfortunate that, you know, it's the way it is, and I'd love to see it change.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. And, you know, that comes with people have to be a little more invested in watching the games and understanding how the game's working. And, you know, sometimes you get into those postseason meetings and it comes down to, well, you know, my kid had 78 goals and your kid only had 72 goals. So my guy should be first team. And sometimes that happens, and, you know, it's a flaw in the system, but it is what it is.
I've always wanted to be in one of those meetings.
I have and you? It's not fun.
It's not fun, right?
No, it's not fun. You realize who your allies are very quickly and who your enemies are, you know? You know, yeah. If you don't vote for their guy, look out.
Yeah. Coach, what's that like for you? Do you go into those just ready to go and knowing that your guys deserve this and that, or are you kind of, you know, amenable to changes, I guess? Yeah.
You know, I do have to give my league props on that. The Tri-Valley coaches have been tremendous. You know, guys come in and we kind of present our arguments about guys. Nobody has taken it personally. Nobody has, you know, come in and demanded anything. And our meetings tend to go pretty well. I've heard some horror stories from other coaches about how their league meetings go. But I got to tell you, the stuff in the Tri-Valley League has really been something that I'm very proud to be a part of. You know, guys are communicative. We talk about it and we try to come up with the best answers to all of those questions. But yeah, so some of the stories you hear are awful.
And how do you come to an agreement in terms of who's an All-American and who's first team all league? Is it just based on coaches' votes?
Yep. We vote in the Tri-Valley League.
Coach, I think that's going to do it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Guys, thanks for having me. This was great.
You were very fast and very succinct. I will give you that. It was
a lot of
fun.
Information. Yeah. That was 40 minutes. That went very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Awesome. Great.
Thanks for your time. Fantastic. Good luck the rest of the way, Todd.
All right, guys. I appreciate it. And same to you. And if you ever want to come to a game, let me know. I'll leave you some tickets.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You got it. Sounds Take great. Care, guys.
Thanks again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piattelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time. Thanks again to Big Saf in the chair.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.